Refugees and border walls, woke celebs and socialist chic, social engineering and COVID lockdowns. It's easy to get wound up over what's happening in our country and in the world. That's why it's time for Act and Unwind, a weekly roundtable discussion tackling current events from the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. Every Monday, join host Eric Cohen and Acton Institute experts, including Dr. Samuel Gregg, Reverend Robert Sirico, Dr. Stephen Barrows, and more in this weekly audio public square where news, politics, religion, and culture meet for an ongoing conversation on a free and virtuous society. Act and Unwind will explain the news of the week through the Acton Institute's unique perspective, connecting good intentions with sound economics as it works to promote and to shape a society that is secure, free, and virtuous, one characterized by individual liberty and sustained by religious principles. To subscribe to Act and Unwind, visit acton.org/NR or search Act and Unwind on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever fine podcasts are available. That's acton.org/NR. To subscribe, please check it out.
Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the Capitol Record podcast. We're in the home stretch of 2021. We want to finish the year strong. And to follow up on last week's all-star podcast with Judy Shelton, one vote away from the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, one of my favorite Capitol Record podcasts we've yet had, this week we've come back with yet another cogent voice in the realm of monetary policy, fiscal policy, and one of the most ardent defenders of free enterprise and a moral defense of markets that I have ever been around, and that is Steve Forbes. Many will remember that in 1996 and 2000, Steve was a viable candidate for president and kind of made his name on his flat tax proposal, which, by the way, I will point out was endorsed by none other than Jerry Brown, who was a Democrat candidate running against Bill Clinton and became two-term governor of the state of California, which I guess makes it more like a four-term governor since he, you know, had served previously in a different decade. The flat tax idea is something that was really brought to the public conversation by Steve Forbes. And today it isn't very close to becoming policy, but it's most certainly something that people understand represents a tremendous inequity and economic inefficiency in our system. And Steve is a supply-sider to the core. He believes in incentives in economics. He believes in productivity, and he is an absolute happy warrior, doesn't fight with anyone, is not looking to get into the sandbox of political discourse, doesn't walk around throwing mud. He is simply a reasoned, cogent thinker for the cause of free enterprise. I'm going to have a nice little conversation with Steve Forbes right now. So with that said, welcome to a new Capitol Record podcast and our first time guest, Mr. Steve Forbes. Steve, welcome to Capitol Record.
Good to be with you, David. Thank you.
So I created this podcast with National Review as a means of defending free enterprise and defending the concept of capital markets in a time where those concepts seem to be under attack. And we've been really blessed to have great economists, great leaders, some great entrepreneurs, businessmen, money managers, and so forth that have come that share this ideology of defending free enterprise. But you were one of my great mentors in the very concept of the merits and the moral foundation of markets going back now many, many years. And I wonder if you could comment on why you think we're in a time that there is such a need to defend free enterprise. Why wasn't the testimony of the 20th century enough?
Because people go by their most recent experiences often. You combine that with the lack of education in schools, starting with the civics. It's not even taught anymore. Immigrants to this country, legal immigrants who want to become citizens, end up knowing more about this country than our own citizens do. So you combine a 20-year period where the economy overall hasn't done that well, not because of a failure of free enterprise, but because of obstacles and mistakes made by government. But the amazing thing is, which we saw with the Great Depression and afterwards, whenever governments fail, they get more power. It's a rather perverse, the exact opposite of free markets, where if you don't provide a product or service that somebody wants, you're not going to succeed. And government almost seems to be the opposite. The worse they do, the more power they get. And we see this unfolding today, where they're putting tentacles in all facets of American life, not just economic, but personal, trying to get a hold of a pre-K, trying to get a hold of childcare and everything else. So when we see intimidation, whether it's of parents, whether it's of journalists, this is quite an assault they're putting on right now, the far left. We have to fight back, and I think we'll fight back and win.
Do you think that there are concerns even amongst the right at defending the virtues of markets? What you describe from the left is very obviously true, but we've come to expect it. The progressives' low regard for freedom and for decision making and decentralized power is well known. It does seem to me that there's concerns on the right about the efficacy of market mechanisms, of price discovery, free exchange. Do you think I'm being overly pessimistic?
There certainly are people on the right who are having real questions. They even question Ronald Reagan's program of low taxes and a sound dollar and deregulation. They forget, like the Constitution, just because you have a rough period where mistakes have been made does not mean you throw the Constitution out, as the progressives have wanted to do for 100 years, many of them, starting with Woodrow Wilson, before he was president, thought the Constitution was an antique document not meant for a modern age. They believe this naive belief in experts can manage things so well from the top. So they tend to overlook the basics. If you have sound money, by sound money, I mean a dollar that doesn't change in value any more than the number of minutes in an hour changes, or the number, the size of a gallon of gasoline, that size doesn't change each day. Combined with low tax rates, I just love a simple flat tax to allow us to focus our energies and brains on something useful instead of this corrupt code. You start with those two basics, low tax rates, and a sound currency, by golly, other good things can happen. And we already saw with deregulation what that did in a brief period of time before COVID. So I think it's clear if we stick to basic principles, a lot of the things that concern the right will go away. You know, they're concerned about size of big companies, especially in high tech. Well, the fact of the matter is, if you have true free markets, those things change. I'm old enough to remember when GM was a target of potential target of antitrust of trust busters back in the 50s and 60s. It's giant. Same with IBM. Same with Walmart. Same with Microsoft, which has come back in the cloud now. So they're starting to get mad at Microsoft again. But you look at the cloud. Who are the two big players? Microsoft and Amazon. But if you look more closely, you find a number of new players coming in. So if you have the environment, David, where small companies, startups can come in and not be encumbered by regulations, such as they're trying to do in the energy industry, where only a few big companies will survive and they'll starve out through a lack of financing, deliberate lack of financing by the government, of telling banks not to finance the wildcatters out there. Yes, you're going to get biggies. But if you have open free markets, today's biggies become tomorrow's dinosaurs, albatrosses. And then they have to reinvent themselves or disappear.
And so competition is the solution there. But you bring up the issue about energy. Let me stick on that for a moment. Do you have fears that they are succeeding in cutting off capital into the space? Or do you believe that markets are working where even some of these ESG guys and the big traditional funders of equity and debt into the energy sector, maybe they're getting cold feet around the politically correct, you know, greenism of the day, but our private markets, more opportunistic, venture-oriented investors picking up the slack? That's what I seem to be seeing from my desk. I wonder about your view.
I think you're seeing both things happening. I think you're starting to see a very serious pushback on this whole counterculture, cancel culture, the idea that government knows best. And I thought you saw that with Virginia and New Jersey in the elections. You're seeing it in pushback by parents when, thanks to COVID lockdowns, they actually got to see firsthand what was being done to their kids in the public schools. So you're now having a real push for education savings accounts and the like, scholarships and the like, to give parents genuine choice where the parents control the money, not government bureaucrats and politicians. So so you're getting that pushback. You're starting to get a counter-revolution or a true revolution, going back to the original ideas of the American Revolution, not the backward ideas of tyranny from the far left. But unfortunately, though, as you know, in energy requires a lot of money. And if you're not sure about future pricing, if you're, you know, you might make an investment today, and with this crowd coming in tomorrow, they can pull the rug out from under you. And you saw that from day one with what happened to a certain pipeline that was suddenly canceled after years of litigation, finally looked like it was underway, and then Biden killed it from day one, and other pipelines they're attacking. So in that kind of uncertainty environment, it's pretty tough to move forward.
Well, and so I guess with it being tougher to move forward and the various impediments and hindrances that they're putting in front, I'm wondering if there's an optimistic angle where market mechanisms will overcome, the profit motive will overcome, human innovation, ingenuity. I'm of this little controversial opinion that the popularity of ESG has been vastly overstated by the coincident underperformance of energy from 2014 to 2019, as the system purged itself of the excesses from the fracking revolution, the overinvestment and you know, the OPEC issues in 2015 and so forth, and that it put a shine on ESG that just by merely being underinvested in fossils made them look better. Now they potentially face a period of significant underperformance. Energy sector is up 50% year to date. And I wonder if maybe we're about to find out if ESG is really the marketing miracle many thought it was.
Well, I think you're getting more and more of a reaction as the Democrats show their real hand. For example, trying to put restrictions on IRAs and 401ks, trying to get in the way of Roth conversions and the like, and trying to green the portfolios by diktat instead of by your own choice. So people don't like that. So as people learn more, that's why the Democrats were so intent, the far left was so intent to push this so quickly, because the more people found out, the more they're turned off by it. And you're right about the marketplace marvelously coming up with ways to upend a government heavy-handedness. And that's why we have to preach the virtues of freedom, innovation. I'm old enough to remember back in the early 1970s, the invention of something called money market funds. As you know, coming out of the Depression, interest rates were regulated, the so-called Regulation Q. And what blasted those regulations and interest rates away was, thanks to technology, you could invent a fund that could keep, thanks to the technology, you could keep the NAV, the net asset value, around a dollar. And therefore, people with a $500, $1,000 could get the same kind of rate in the money market as could people with $100,000 or $1 million. It was a real miracle of creative capitalism. And so they had to get rid of Regulation Q, and banks got the permission to start their own money market funds and start offering real market rates. Now, unfortunately, the Federal Reserve and other central banks have mucked up the market since 2008, 2009, but that's going to change. But you see what's unfolding in the whole healthcare center, where the government wants to take it over. What has happened in recent years? Most companies have now gone for high deductible plans just because of the cost. So now consumers are finding out, patients are finding out what the real cost of energy is, or what they charge for certain things. And so you're starting to see develop a consumer market for people wanting to know, what am I being charged for this, since I'm now having to pay for so much of it now? So I think you're going to see that phenomenon in the next few years, especially as HR departments and companies finally wake up as to the silliness of the system we have today and start to tap into this wonderful consumer market. I think you're going to have a huge burst of creativity, innovation in healthcare, where we get more healthcare at less cost, just like we do in high tech.
Would you like to see the delivery of healthcare insurance disintermediated from employers Do you think the employer-based insurance model is broken, or is your concern really more just getting the government out?
Well, it's a whole third party system. You mentioned most of us get it through employer based system, but we also know Medicare and Medicaid are huge factors in the marketplace. So it's the third party system, and nobody designed it. So I'm not pointing fingers at villains or anything like that. It was done, as you know, came out of World War II controls, came out of changes in the IRS and the tax code. So nobody designed it. But I think instead of saying, should we have employer, non-employer based, I think the thing is going to evolve in a way. You remember in the old days when you had TIA, CREF, before they were separated or changed their name, where if you were a teacher, a school administrator, you could go from one school to another school, but your pension plan, annuity plan went with you. I think you're going to see develop the same thing in healthcare, where you own the plan. Your employer may finance it to get you to sign on the dotted line to work for them. But if you leave, the plan goes with you.
And that idea has worked in a number of other venues, as you bring up. There's precedent, portability, choice, competition, puts downward pressure on prices. Steve, I've been reading you my entire adult life, and really before my adult life, and you've always been very consistent on these principles. You know, there are a lot of market advocates that seem to me become uncomfortable at some of the rough edges of markets at times, can be uncomfortable with creative destruction, can be uncomfortable with the negative effects of progress that for a small period of time can leave some behind. And yet you've always had a remarkable consistency in holding to the principles of competition, of freedom, of free exchange. When it comes to things like healthcare, when we talk about innovations in finance and insurance, why do people who are otherwise sympathetic to markets make exceptions and invite systems that they know don't work in the rest of humanity, but they're convinced will work in this one space? Why the lack of consistency from market advocates?
Two reasons. One is self-interest. And a classic example of that is what a lot of states have in terms of you have to get permission if you want to set up a clinic, you want to set up a hospital, operating agreements. And you don't have that, say, if Dunkin' Donuts wants to set up a store next to Starbucks, you don't have to get permission from the government to do that. You just go and do it. And so you have people who preach and love free markets, but not when it comes to allowing hospitals to compete with your hospital very easily. So you have that factor. But you also have the factor that people genuinely believe healthcare is different. And they always say, well, if you have a heart attack, you're not going to negotiate with your provider as to what you want or don't want. But that's like saying, well, you can't have homeowners insurance because you're not going to negotiate when your house is on fire. So you get the insurance in advance. That's the whole point of insurance. And as you know, with medicine, most medicine, thankfully, is not of an emergency nature. Even if you're diagnosed with cancer, as I was a decade ago, you have days or even weeks to make choices about what kind of treatments you might take and things like that. So healthcare, yes, it's different, just as every industry is different from other industries, but the principles are the same. And we see it in food. Without food, you don't have healthcare. We don't have government-run farms. They tried that in China and Russia with catastrophic results. So we have effective safety nets. Now, the way food stamps sadly have been run have not always been very good, but the concept is sound. There is a safety net there for everybody. And the same can be true in healthcare. And the thing is, when you look at a country like Singapore, which uses free market principles in healthcare, they have universal coverage, but prices are about a third of the U.S. Or you look at the Surgery Center of Oklahoma here in this country, because they do things differently, they don't take insurance, their prices are so low that people with insurance find out they save money because of their high deductibles by going to the surgery center and having the knee replaced or something like that. So, yes, industries are different. And so people always think, well, yeah, it can work in general, but it can't work here. It can evolve and work here. And you hit on, though, something, David, extremely important with change. Change can be disruptive. And that's where you get pushes for protectionism. people suddenly find that what they've been doing has now been upended. And that can be disruptive. I mean, you look at the whole history of agriculture in this country, which was once the predominant part of our economy. You saw it in the late 1800s, when we had massive increases in productivity, which led to low commodity prices, great for the consumer, but led to massive farm protest movements. They thought the bankers were euchering them. And you see it right into this century. And one of the things politics in its finest form, which we're certainly not seeing today, but in its finest form is to try to find ways, how do you ease the transition without setting up permanent programs, but ease transition to make it easier, grease the skid, so to speak, to get these new things without destroying them or doing what Europe did and create a whole farming sector that is dominant and they can't do anything about it, utterly inefficient. And so that's an art. And that's truly the art of politics we don't see enough of today. How do you make it possible to make these transitions? And as you know, the best way is to have an open economy, because people do make the transition. Even with my idea of a flat tax, people say, what are you going to do with those tax lawyers? My attitude is, if you've got the brain power to know anything about this crazy tax code, you're going to do very well in this information age. There'll be a demand for your services, and especially with a prosperous economy, when you have labor shortages, people will say, I'll train you to be whatever it is we need to be. So that's the kind of environment you want, where people are going to go in and we'll make sure you get the skills. And the other thing that's got to be done in education is remove this idea that everyone has to have a four-year college degree. Some people may want that, but others may not. And you can get online any kind of education you want now. I think you're going to see more of that in the future.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's something that has been a passion of mine for some time. That, you know, the healthcare side, I agree with 100%. And there's a principled argument for market forces to drive more of healthcare delivery in our country. But it's certainly complicated. There's a lot to unwind. But the college education thing, I just can't believe that we're sitting here with the technological capabilities we have, and yet for no other reason than the self-interest of these administrators and university boards and bureaucrats holding on to a model that is really out of the 18th century. And I wonder when those monopolistic strangleholds will be torn down and market forces will be allowed to bring costs down and quality up in what passes for college education in this country.
Well, I think the key there is getting the information out. Why is it that a high percentage, I've heard as high as half of the kids who enter freshman college today are not going to get a degree within 6 years, but they're going to keep the debt. And so I think you're going to see a real push for reforms. If a kid takes a loan, part of it is going to be the liability of the university or the college. So they will have an interest in making sure this is the right thing for you to do, instead of just taking the money and saying you're on your own. So the key thing there is get the information out. I think you're going to start to see profound changes. I think you're also going to start to see, since so many smart kids are going in the workforce, so to speak, going with startups at the age of 18 or 19, the stigma of you haven't graduated formally from college, which they really hammered home after World War II, is going to go away. And you're going to see certificates of proficiency. And if you want to get a formal degree, you can online. And so I think you're going to see a blossoming of and doing it with 3 years instead of 4 years, law school in 2 years instead of 3 years. I think in law, you're even going to see a resurrection more of what they used to call reading the law, where you'd work for a firm for 2 or 3 years and then maybe do some studying and then take the bar exam. So one size does not fit all. And I think you're going to see a real proliferation of that in traditionally hide-abound, one-size-fits-all industries.
Well, I believe you're right. I'm optimistic about it. It is, I think, a tremendous injustice that we've allowed this system to continue going in that route. I wonder, you know, from an innovation standpoint, Steve, do you have any thoughts on some of these models that are sort of revenue sharing, an investor, so to speak, invest in the education expense of someone who qualifies and then gets a piece of their earnings power for a certain period of time?
Do you think that's a good innovation, or is there something about that you find problematic?
I'm a little skittish about it, but I know places like, I think, Purdue and others, I think are pursuing that, the idea of that. So maybe try it. But what I don't want is the feeling that a kid leaves college, or a young man or a young woman leaves college, feeling like they're an indentured servant for a while, especially in medicine, where they have taken on so much debt that they feel they must go to work as an employee of a hospital chain or something like that, rather than saying, well, maybe I'm going to try this on my own. There are certain areas of need, and I'm going to join a small practice or even start my own. So I just want to get away from this whole indentured idea. When you get the diploma, you're free to choose.
No, I certainly agree. I of course, the free to choose could apply to someone choosing not to enter into such an agreement on the front end as well. But I agree there could be back end problems. But my point is more just the ability to try different things. One could argue there's an indentured nature to the student loan basis we have now.
Yes.
People lose portability. They lose mobility. They lose flexibility. And I think that we need economic dynamism to come back, and we're just not doing it.
I agree.
So I'll leave with a subject that has to be discussed in the current day and age, but probably deserves more time than we have. But we talk about freedom. We talk about the government getting out of the way, letting markets work, all the things that you and I care about so much. And then we come to the subject of the Fed. And it does seem to me, post-financial crisis and now post-COVID, that this the horse, what is the expression? The horse has left the barn. Our addiction to the Fed as a sort of smoother of business cycle disruptions, as a facilitator of financial markets. I don't think they can call it the Greenspan put anymore about the stock market. It's all Fed governors about the stock market, the municipal bond market, the commercial mortgage market. And I wonder if this, more than any other factor, is holding down our ability to get dynamic growth, because low cost of capital is keeping zombie companies alive, and we're not getting the creative destruction that is necessary to advance our economy, technologically, innovation, idea, all those wealth creating things you and I love. Am I on the right track here, Steve?
Of course. And one thing to remember is markets are people. When they say the markets have flaws or you can't trust the markets, what they're saying is we don't trust democracy. We don't trust people to do what we think they should be doing. And so you get these crazy things like vaccine dictates, where they, this is part of the modern socialism, where they have try to make businesses do their policing and have them take the blame for it. And we all know if you've had the disease, for example, if you had COVID, your immunities are 27 times stronger than the vaccines, right, though they may be. So, yes, that's a real challenge out there. And but I think looking forward, the thing we have to again do is emphasize that when you free things up, you get the most surprising creations from the most unlikely avenues, and things that are today's luxuries become tomorrow's commonplaces. As you know, David, if we had told 20 years ago grandma could operate a supercomputer, you'd have been given a strange look. Today, grandma and everyone else has their handhelds, which would have the power and capabilities of even more capabilities of supercomputers 20, 25 years ago. So in the whole panoply of things, and with the Federal Reserve, the idea that a handful of people can guide a 330 million people economy, not to mention the 8 billion people around the world, is just so preposterous. That should have gone out with the Berlin Wall falling in 1989. And so I think the Fed is overreached. They're using the Fed to do bad things. And you're right. Why should Apple Computer take tens of billions of dollars of debt when they're rolling in cash and create cash machine? They're always turning out stuff we can't do without. reason is because of how the markets have been distorted. So it's free money. And you're right. A lot of companies that should have had those assets go to more productive uses aren't. And you're also seeing it harder for small businesses to have a startup because they don't have the kind of balance sheet that can say, okay, we can give you free money and get assured you're going to get paid back. So you saw it in Japan back in the 1980s, zombie companies, after that market unraveled. And you're seeing it again today. So the sooner the Fed goes to, I think, a Bretton Woods gold standard, and the sooner that we allow people to set prices again, I think we'll see a very dynamic economy, a very vibrant economy, and people creating things are going to enrich all of us. And the thing is, they talk about income inequality, but what we were seeing real reductions with that, David, is less inequality in the standard of living. Somebody living well today in the 1%, within a few years, 95% will have that and more.
Well, that's exactly right. And that ability to see the aspirational nature of markets is what we can't lose sight of. And to defend the idea of class mobility, class warfare doesn't work if everyone's mobile amongst classes. Steve, I'm teaching 16 and 17 year olds economics in Newport Beach, California. And I talked about how we would never look at someone who's in a wheelchair because they hurt their leg in a basketball game and they've already kind of had their medical treatment and they're going to get out of the wheelchair in a day or two. They're just sort of finishing up their recovery. We would never refer to them as handicapped. And yet we do it all the time in a market system where someone may be in a particular economic stage of life now, but our system allows them to have mobility, to have vertical mobility, to have aspiration. And yet we still refer to them in a class struggle context as if they're permanently handicapped. And I think it's Marxian, but I also think it is tremendously dishonest to what the beauty of enterprise actually allows.
Well, what Abraham Lincoln talked about, a chance to improve your lot in life on a level playing field. That's what people want. Nobody cares how much money Jeff Bezos has, as long as he's delivering the goods. And as long as you are having the opportunity to improve your life, you're not going to worry about others.
Well, amen. Steve, I know how busy you are, and I appreciate you taking the time to come speak to Capitol Record. And for those who are listening, we have had Larry Kudlow, we've had Steve Moore, we've had Art Laffer a couple times. This cast of characters and the Committee to Unleash Prosperity and the work they're doing to continue fighting for a free and virtuous society, fighting for some of the supply side ideas, not just as mere political policy tools, but much more than that, ideas that help unleash prosperity in a market economy. These are the men, and in my case, the heroes that are fighting the good fight. I hope you'll continue paying attention to their work. And I hope, Steve Forbes, that you'll come back and be with us again.
Looking forward to it, David, and continue your good work. Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. I hope you see what I mean about Steve's disposition, demeanor. I first got close with Steve out of different efforts with the Club for Growth. And from there, he and other Capitol Record guests, Steve Moore, Art Laffer, Larry Kudlow, launched the Committee to Unleash Prosperity, which I've been a part of since it began. And this is a cause that is activist-oriented, but also very, very think tank-driven. We want to be out in the public square with policy ideas, and those policy ideas sometimes get enacted and help change the world. In the meantime, the cause is that of free enterprise. Capital markets is the sine qua non in the cause of a free society. Steve Forbes is one such guest helping to make it happen. So I'm grateful to Steve for joining us, grateful to you all for listening to Capitol Record, and look forward to a couple other really special episodes as we close out 2021. Thank you, as always, for listening to, rating, reviewing, and sharing the Capitol Record.